Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Gore Vidal. Vidal was that rare writer who was also a public figure. He was at once capable of writing 24 novels and more than 200 essays in his lifetime, and also wrote extensively for film and television, regularly debated politics on television talk shows, had a credible run for congressional office, and even dabbled in acting. Among Vidal's most famous works are his historic novels, Julian, Lincoln, and the controversial social novel, Myra Breckinridge. His political nonfiction, United States Essays, 1952 to 1992, won the National Book Award, and his memoir, Palimpsest, was a bestseller, and his screenplay for Ben-Hur won the Academy Award for Best Picture. Here's Gore Vidal in 1999 as part of Portland Arts and Lectures at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
I've tried to imagine what any or all of the 600 of you out there would like to hear Gore Vidal talk about so that I could ask those questions. But I think the answer is you'd like to hear him talk about anything and everything, so I feel safe in asking anything. So I thought I'd start with this one. It's been said that between your relatives and your friends and your lovers, there's hardly any recent figure in recent history from JFK to Sartre to half of Hollywood whom you don't know. Let's start with the evening on a positive note. Who is the least admirable public figure of your acquaintance?
Well, that's a pretty long list. I would place on that list every single visible candidate for president in 2000. You know, every election we always say it can't get any worse. And it does. I change day to day. I see George W. Bush, and I wonder, what on earth is he doing running for president? I mean, I could see him, you know, at a golf course or something in charge of the links or whatever they call them. And then I realize he's running for president because his father was president. His father was a very poor president, but a lot of money was invested. It comes down to really investment in the name George Bush, because his father was elected once president and ran a second time. They can't let that money go to waste. The Kennedys are in the same terrible situation. A third, fourth generation of Kennedys, you know, they're trapped by the investment in their name. So it might be that we should spend a little less money on investing in the names. I mean, because between George Bush and George W. Bush, I would say that they're mean IQ Fahrenheit would hardly warm this room. Now you see me toadying to the powerful.
Well, here's a much harder question. What about the smartest public figure of your acquaintance?
American?
Would there be somebody in the United States we could talk about?
Well, I don't know everybody, you know. I mean, I know, you know, only the usual suspects. I'm sure they're brilliant people, I must say. I'm told there's a police chief in Denver who's extremely intelligent and collects Horace Walpole, but I haven't talked to him, you know. He's just a name to me. I would say that the really bright man in the United States would never run for president now. He'd be too intelligent. You have to take your orders, and the orders come from corporate America, which pays for the campaigns. George W. Bush did not get, you know, $37 million in a few months because he knew geography, for instance. I mean, he got it for his name and the fact that he'd be obedient. People have often wondered, you know, how on earth Ronald Reagan was picked. Well, he was picked because he was a good actor and he delivered the commercials. But he had I was in Hollywood as a contract writer at MGM when he had just gone into television, and he was the actor who never questioned what the front office told him to do. He was the most obedient man. And he was known as Hit Your Mark, Ron, which is what you tell people in the movies, so that as you come out and you remember to hit your mark, so you'll be right there for the camera. Well, he's wonderful at hitting his mark and gives no one any trouble at all. He's a genuinely nice man. And he served loyally the people who had put up the money to run him. So I'd think that he doesn't mind because he spent his entire life doing that in Hollywood under the studio system. Anybody autonomous in nature and anyone who has ideas and who cares even marginally about the Republic wouldn't put up with that. They're not going to hit the mark for anybody. They're going to try and move the mark or change the mark or illuminate the mark for the people. And they wouldn't have a chance of being nominated, nor would they have a chance of raising $35 million. Of course, we have thoughtful people like Senator Bradley. Many of my friends in New York like him. And I thought it was wonderful that he took his time to go up on the mountain and discover at last he was ready. I mean, that was, my God, I trembled with excitement. This is a leader. The others are hustlers. They're just rushing around, you know. Mr. Forbes, you know, who looks like his father's money just landed on his head and his eyes are out of focus. But Bradley just comes on, I am ready to be your president. And I thought, oh, my God, to live in a country. You know, I'm so grateful that he's ready, you know, to govern me. I mean, I've felt the need of governance for some time. But I can go on for hours in this gloomy vein.
You've been a political figure yourself, as well as obviously a literary one.
I didn't have the financing they did.
You're the grandson of a senator and a relative of the current vice president, Al Gore, and you ran for Congress in the state of New York, my home state. I know that, in a way, you're a special case because you grew up around politics and were raised with politics, but do you think writers have some sort of political responsibility in the Republic?
No, they have if they're interested. I think everybody, it was Pericles is supposed to have said to Sophocles, who said that he had no interest in politics, and Pericles said, the man who says he has no interest in politics has no life, has no place in the state, meaning Athens. No, I think everybody should participate as best he can. Writers are disdained in America because it's a country that was based upon anti-intellectualism. Not the 18th century America, where learning was valued, but by the 19th century, it was rather disdained, and a writer was thought to be so unworldly and this and that. But there have been writers who've been quite brilliant in politics. They don't have to run for office. They have to make those running for office run. I think of Mark Twain. I mean, he had more political influence than a dozen presidents. And terribly funny he was on the subject. And his attacks on imperialism, colonialism, the time of when we picked the war with Spain, known as the Spanish-American War, we did it deliberately in order to get the Spanish possessions, particularly the Philippines, which gave us the Pacific. And we slaughtered something like 200,000 Filipinos after having promised that we would liberate them. And Mark Twain went across the country with a lecture that began the stars and stripes that we so revere in our flag should now be replaced with a skull and crossbones. He was quite effective. On the other hand, it wasn't until 1948 that we let the Filipinos from our friendly grasp.
That brings to mind another question. I'm sure that you've heard the following. In America, only the successful writer is important. In France, all writers are important. In England, no writer is important. And in Australia, you have to tell them what a writer is. So using Mark Twain and maybe yourself as examples, what's your view of the role of the writer in late 20th century, about to be 21st century America?
Trying to find a publisher. Listen, this could all die out with these great conglomerates buying up publishing houses and so on, and fewer readers, basically. I think literature is in for a very bad time. So I would think the first thing for a writer to do is write, obviously. But those politically minded, I mean, the writer is the one who defines the prospect for his fellow citizens. That was the virtue of the essay, particularly by the greatest of all essays, Montaigne. And Montaigne is speaking for anybody who can read him. And he does nothing but talk about politics and how to run a country. He was mayor of Bordeaux for two terms in the 16th century. He starts one essay. I hear complaints that during the two terms that I was mayor of Bordeaux that nothing happened. This was the triumph of my life. He was probably a Calvin Coolidge man. However, there are times when we want rest.
Now, those of us that are familiar with your work know what you hate about America.
Hate anything about America.
Opportunism and hypocrisy of politics.
That's not American. That's universal.
It's
the system. This woman came to me from the New York Times in the days when I made the mistake of ever allowing a journalist near me. I do it all by fax now, and even then they become creative. But this little axe murderess came in and... And she said she loved William F. Buckley, Jr., may I say. And she said, Mr. Vidal, she began, they always have sweet little voices, you know. Mr. Vidal, you really hate the American people, don't you? And I said, no, I hate the New York Times. It is not the same thing. And there was a photographer and his assistant there, and I made them sign a document right there in the Plaza Hotel that she had opened with this line and not I, because she was going to change it around. No, it is the system I dislike. I am a true reactionary. I would like to dispose of the empire and go back to representative government, which we've not had basically since Harry Truman militarized the economy in 1950 with the help of Dean Acheson. I would like to see a restoration of our rights. I would like to see an end to the harassment of the citizen. I am carrying in my pocket a passport in my own country. We want an ID with a picture on it. I'm sorry, you can't go on that line because you don't have an ID with a picture on it. Well, surely you have a driver's license. I said, I don't have a driver's license. So I now carry a passport so that I can travel in the United States. It's a police state, and nobody objects. People just sit there being pushed this way and that way and ordered around. Only a few gray heads, white heads here probably remember what it was like when it was a free country, but it was a pretty good place.
Well, my question that began incorrectly with what do you hate about America was actually leading to tell us what you love about this country.
Well, the possibilities of change have always been part of the American temperament. There comes a time when they may not be able to change. That's my worry. We often collectively do extremely stupid things. I draw your attention to 1919 and the Volstead Act, when prohibition was made the law of the land and set the United States not only on the biggest drunk it's ever been on, but made it cops and robbers. It was a crime wave such as the world had never seen. And in 1933, it was quite a long time, but by 33, the new president, Franklin Roosevelt, repealed it. Well, other countries, more traditionally minded, once they got a really bad law, would stay with it, you know. The English would make it work. So you can't go to the pub on Sunday, you know, and you cannot sell sweaters on Sunday afternoon, and you cannot do this. I mean, they love prohibitions, and we inherited a lot of that from the Brits, but I think our ability to change, though Vietnam was very disturbing, that everybody hated it, and yet such was the power of the press, which is all part of the corporate ownership of the country, and that light at the end of the tunnel, and the dementedness of Johnson and then Nixon and Kissinger. They were going to drag it on because America must stand tall. In Southeast Asia, I mean, you know, we had no business being there. And then Robert McNamara writes a memoir, and he confesses, you know, I didn't really know what it was about. I knew he didn't know at the time. One look into that empty, stupid face, I hate to characterize. I mean, he was, I no offense to accountants here, but I could see him at Ford, you know, adding up a series of figures. Well, that's fine at Ford, and I'm sure he's very creative there. But when the figures represent dead people, I don't think it's a good thing. I used to go on television. I was the official voice of the anti-war people starting in 64. And I have debated everybody. And I realized they didn't know what they were doing. Why are we there, I would say. We're there to contain China. Now, China, you know, was they had a few bamboo spears at that time, but were no danger to us. Well, I said, if you're there to contain China, did you know, it's always a wonderful way to begin with a government official, did you know that the Indo-Chinese have been enemies of China for 1,000 years? And if you don't like the Chinese, you help the Indo-Chinese, and they will act as a buffer. I might just as well have said the Pelagian heresy will never take place in South Portland. They were just boom. You just see, certain things don't get through. What ought not to be said was not said. And that is part of the charm of our medium.
So political satire takes place every day. You write about it.
Every day satire, political tragedy too. There's another fellow in my line of work, is Paul Revere of the later days of the Republic, and that's Noam Chomsky. And Noam can't get his name in the New York Times, other than under linguistics. But he goes around talking about these matters, and he told me he went to his dentist not long ago, and the dentist said, your teeth are fine, but you've got to stop grinding them. No, he said, I don't grind my teeth. Well, he said, you do. The enamel's all worn down. And Mrs. Chomsky was called in, and he said, he mustn't. When does he grind his teeth? She said, he doesn't grind his teeth. Maybe at night when he's asleep. She listened a couple of nights. No, he doesn't grind them in his sleep. And then finally one morning, as they were having coffee, he picked up the New York Times.
Well, let's talk about writing a little bit. Your novel, The Smithsonian Institution, is out in paperback right now, and it's a mixture of history and science fiction and adventure and romance and political satire. Can you tell us a little bit about that book?
Well, it's a very short book, but contains many different things. No, it's about a kid who's in 1939. He's a genius at 13, a quantum physicist. And his Smithsonian, which I've invented for him, comes alive. The exhibits come alive at night, which is what I always wished they would do when I was a kid and being dragged through there. And he's been asked to come and work on the atomic bomb. They have a lot of people there in the basement of the Smithsonian, including Einstein arrives. And he gets interested in time travel, and is able to indulge in it to a degree. And he realizes, he looks ahead, fasts forward, and discovers that he's going to be killed in the war, which is coming. So he decides he's going to stop World War II. Meanwhile, he's fallen in love with Mrs. Grover Cleveland, who is a very beautiful girl of 24, married in the White House to Grover, who was one of our nicest presidents. And so he talks to Grover Cleveland about how to avoid World War II, which is about to happen. And Cleveland said, well, the only way you can do that is to avoid World War I. And the only way you can do that is get rid of that god-awful Professor Wilson at Princeton and make sure he isn't president, and we will never go into the war if we have somebody decent, you know, in the Democratic Party. So the boy and Mrs. Cleveland go back in time to the moment where Woodrow Wilson is being offered the governorship of New Jersey, which then launches him into the presidency. And they blackmail him. He has a girlfriend, a lady who reads poetry to him in Bermuda. That's what they did then. There were no cigars. There was nothing sleazy in our presidential relationships. They read Lorna Doone. And they blackmail Wilson, and he doesn't run. And we get instead William Jennings Bryan, who keeps us out of the war. The kid has not looked far enough forward into the future. He doesn't see Pearl Harbor. So that happens anyway. He gets killed, and then he is put back together again by a friend from school. Meanwhile, there's a nice scene. The presidents come alive at night, and they call George Washington calls in Roosevelt, and they catch him during a nightmare. And he arrives with Eleanor, complaining like nobody's business. It's typical of your nightmare that I would end up here in the Smithsonian before my time. And it's a kangaroo court. They ask him, why did the Japanese attack us at Pearl Harbor? And he won't answer. And they couldn't know that. As of 1995, we know, because the military codes of the Japanese that we had broken as of 1940 have all, under the Freedom of Information Act, are available. And there's a book by Mr. Stinnett, which I highly recommend to you, called, I think, Day of Deceit, which shows to what extent Roosevelt was aware of the coming of the war, that we were going to be hit. He thought it would be someplace like Manila and it wouldn't be so horrific. He deeply feared impeachment when the whole fleet, which he had lined up at Pearl Harbor, got itself sunk. But my book, unlike our history, is a very cheerful one. And the boy is restored by his friend and lives happily ever after, even now at the Smithsonian. Where Abraham Lincoln, who has been, he was dragged out of Ford's theater by another time traveler who tried to get him out before Booth's bullet hit him. Well, the bullet had hit him, but it had not killed him. So he's gaga, and we have a gaga Abraham Lincoln whom they don't know what to do with, so they put him in charge of ceramics. And he's hip, he's wonderful at ceramics. And he gets bequests from the DuPont family, and he's constantly graciously rewarding them for giving them brown glazed early American pottery. And meanwhile, as a minor diversion, he's taken up, this is 1939, he started to read Carl Sandburg about himself, and he just said, what poetry, what poetry, what great poetry. That answer your question about the Smithsonian.
You're listening to a talk by Gore Vidal. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and more with Vidal is coming up. It's Gore Vidal this time. Here he is again speaking in Portland in 1999.
There's actually been quite an uproar recently about the mixing of history and fiction. It seems like every once in a while there's an uproar, and the publication of the Reagan biography, Dutch, has really put it back into the public discussion. What's your take on that book? And as a person who uses historical figures, how close do you stay to...
Well, what I'm writing, I mean, the Smithsonian Institution is a fantasy. It's an invention. Mm-hmm. In a book like Lincoln or Burr, I am sticking very closely to history, and I only have fictional characters to comment on them. If I have Lincoln say something, he actually did say it, because I have found a letter or something to give me a lead. But I saw Edmund Morris at the time he got his contract, and he wrote a wonderful book about Theodore Roosevelt. And I said, this is very surprising that you want to do a book about Reagan. He said, well, I have total access. I said, that's the problem. You're going to have access to a whole lot of nothing. And unfortunately, Edmund Morris was very good on Theodore Roosevelt, but you can do that from the books. He's from Kenya. Well, Kenya is not the best place to study American politics, much less the movies during the studio system. And I said, you know, do you really know enough about all this? And, oh, yes, he said, I'll be able to read up on it. Well, I said, you're going to find there's nobody there, and you're going to find... He's one of the nicest men, Reagan, that ever lived. But you will find there is nobody there. He's not very interested in politics. And he was in the 1950s, when I used to see a bit of him, and we were both working in Hollywood. He was known as, you know, Chester Chatterbox. I mean, strong men would faint when he would come into a room telling stories from the Reader's Digest. And powerful women would, if I may use an obscene word, defenestrate themselves rather than listen to him. I mean, this man was chloroform. But he hit his mark, you know. He worked for General Electric for 17 years. He said, the Russians are coming. The Russians weren't going anywhere, as it proved, but everybody knew that. But it was, you know, they raised money, frightened the people. Bigger and bigger defense budgets, more money for General Electric, which made weaponry in those days. Well, we now read about how Edmund Morris was indeed discovered these terrible truths I told him at the beginning of his journey. And I think what he did was... I haven't read the book. That's why I'm so good on it. I think he did the wisest thing. He realized that Reagan was totally fictional, and he made himself fictional. That was kind of brilliant, you know. I mean, generally with presidents, when we go in for the sort of solemn biographies, it's our God is Parson Weems. But when you deal with somebody invented, totally invented like Reagan, it's Pirandello. So you have an imaginary author in search of an imaginary president.
Now, what place does Reagan have in the Smithsonian?
Well, he isn't in there yet. I'll find something
for
him to do.
Ceramics is already taken, so where?
Ceramics is taken. I mean, you know, Lincoln still has authority, you know, even though he doesn't make much sense. I would probably put him in charge of old movies, really. I think he'd be very good at that. And Morris goes on and says he's not interested in people. Well, of course he is, but he's not interested in the people, in political people. I mean, what really turns on Reagan, and where he talks by the hour, is being president of the Screen Actors Guild, and he'd say, well, that was the time of the Ida Lupino contract. Now, this is 1936, remember? No, it was 37. The Ida Lupino contract was up, you see. And I went in to Jack Warner, Mr. Warner. I never called him Jack. That was the one man I most admired that I ever met, was Mr. Warner. He's a man who's met, you know, Churchill and Roosevelt and so on. Well, he does this by the hour, and that's what I'd have him do in the Smithsonian.
Uh, Books are very public things, and writers are public figures. You are certainly a very public figure. But writing itself is a private act that takes place behind closed doors. And I think that might be why so many people who are readers are so curious about how writers work. Can you tell us something about your writing habits? Where you write, how you write, when you write,
what
you wear when you write?
It's a bit like asking about sex. What are you thinking about? Then you can't do it. Lack of self-consciousness, I would think, is the first thing a writer must learn. You just do it. You know, I've never done anything else. I spoke in Los Angeles a few days ago at a group called Writer's Block, and I said, well, I'm so glad at last somebody's about to give me one. I've been waiting for a writer's block for years, you know. They didn't give it to me. No, I think anyone with a writer's block should say, well, thank God I don't have to do it. You know, I'm not a writer. You're condemned, really, to a kind of life of slavery. But you get so... I do it as naturally as I breathe, and sometimes it's difficult, but more often you don't... I don't even know what I've done. I sit there roaring, and particularly with a comedy like Smithsonian, I sit there roaring with laughter at things that, as they start to happen, because I don't know what's going to happen, and that's why you write, to find out what will happen next. It's a bit like... I was halfway through Myra Breckinridge before I realized that she had been a man. This shows how, sharp my antennae are. And then when I realized she'd been a man, then everything began to fall into play. Oh, that's why she did that, you know. And you write for discovery. You write to find out things. Then when I go to the historical things, these are meditations on history. I study a subject because I want to know about it. And then I want to pass it on to others. So then I write about it. And it's like breaking rocks sometimes, these very long... historical novels, because I do try to be very accurate with the historical parts. And I've done one more, a final one, which comes out in September, I think. And with that, I let drop the feather. Or pen.
So you write with a pen.
I write longhand. Yes, I could tell this now. Let drop the feather would have meant a lot to any audience 50 years ago when I began. I believe they use other things now, but dangerous-looking things.
Writers talk about writing so that they can discover what's going to happen in the book they're writing. But other people say that writers write to teach themselves or to find out something about themselves or to understand themselves. What has your writing or has your writing helped you understand about yourself?
I don't know. I just read something. There's a biography of me out, which I will never read, but somebody writing about it commented that I had no unconscious mind. Well, that was a quotation from Italo Calvino's wife, and this guy was, well, actually it was the writer of the biography who was not very intellectual. And what she meant was, is in the European sense, is the greatest compliment that you can give to any artist or any person. By having no unconscious mind, it means you're using it. Your unconscious is working all the time in your work. So you're not neurotic. Except about small elevators. We all have, you know, hang-ups, but a lack of an unconscious mind means a lack, basically, of neurosis and of things which have been pushed down in your temperament by society, by your own will, whatever. And they poison people. And to have a free unconscious from which you write your books is... can make you as happy as a human being can be in this vale of tears.
You once said, I think this is a terrific thing to say, and some of us probably feel this way, although we're less qualified to say it than you. You said, "I am complacently positive that there is no human problem which could not be solved if people would simply do as I advise."
Yes, very true. How true, how true.
Okay, advise us.
Go back to Philadelphia and get a new constitution and restore the republic and restore representative government. One of the first moves to make is allow no one to contribute, particularly corporate America, to political campaigns. TV. For 30 years, and I've been on television for 30 or 40 years, I've said that they mint money. They should give free time to presidential candidates, federal candidates, free national time, local time if they're running for a state office in Oregon, or municipal time if it's the city of Portland. Free time should be given all the candidates, and a wide range, so you just don't get the ones that are going to serve mysterious masters. This would immediately give you representative government again, which wasn't perfect, but it's certainly better than anything we've had since. And I would say that would be a first step, was to take the money out of it. And I had a friend who once said, basically, we'd be better off with a telephone book. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, if you went through, you wanted to pick a congressman from, let's say, this area, you go through the telephone books and pick them at random, you know. And they said, you'd do better than you do under the present system. You know, just get it with a pin, you know, all right, Mrs. Heidelberg, you're going to be congressman from the 2nd District. And you'd probably get a better group of, and more representative group of people. I said, what about the people without phones? He said, well, you're a socialist, of course, you know. You would say that.
Would you like to open it up to
yes,
the audience?
Well,
Let's hear them.
Well, they will put up the lights. I think if you ask them nicely. Mas Licht, the last words of Goethe, more light. Actually, the actual line was, would you please open the shutter? That's getting dark in here.
Could you share with us some details about why Italy?
Well, that's more my publisher's doing. I said, I live in Italy. I don't live in Italy. I have a house in Italy, and I have a house in the Hollywood Hills. So you can argue that I don't live in America at all, but Italy is, first of all, my father's family were Italian, and the Gores are Anglo-Irish, so between southern Italy and Ulster, I think I made the right familial choice.
I just wanted to mention that I've just finished producing a documentary on Senator Wayne Morse from Oregon, of course, and first wanted to mention that, of course, if you feel like flying in from Hollywood or Italy, you're welcome to come in on the 7th for our premiere. And also wanted to see what you recall of him, because he seemed to be the other only main voice on television, certainly in radio, in 64 and 65 against Vietnam. And wanted to see if you remember anything prior to that, too, of his career.
I didn't know him. I've been on television with him. Well, he's a very noble figure. As was Senator Greening, was it, from Alaska? He was the other senator who came out against the war. And finally, one of the eloquent voices who at the last minute I just kind of finked out was Bill Fulbright of Arkansas. On the other hand, interestingly enough, to the vice president's credit, his father lost his seat in the Senate over the Vietnam War. A kind of moment of courage that I do not think will be repeated in the family. And I should tell you, my grandfather, Senator Gore of Oklahoma, a state that he had invented, he had a great sense of humor. he came from Mississippi. He lost his seat because of his opposition to World War I. So we really were populists in the true sense of the word. We believed in minding our own business, and we saw no point in getting into foreign quarrels. The word isolationist has now been demonized along with liberal, which is a mistake. This is a liberal nation, or tries to be, and it is certainly a nation that believes in minding its own business and not in empires. The great president who was never mentioned is John Quincy Adams. On a 4th of July speech around 1824, I have to paraphrase it, but it's good advice, he said, "The United States is not designed to go forth and slay dragons in other lands. She could become dictatress of the world, but we will have lost our soul." Think of John Quincy Adams, rather better than some of the later ones. Okay?
Mr. Vidal, please don't quit writing and live a long time. I owe you one of the biggest laughs that I've ever had when in one of your essays you talked about when you were writing the screenplay for Ben-Hur, which they left out of the program. And an English actor, Mr. Boyd, I believe, came to you and the director and said in so many words, "There's no motivation for my actions with respect to my co-star, Mr. Charlton Heston." And you gave him some specific advice, which the director of the film took. And Mr. Heston was not aware of this, and it provided the necessary motivation. And then he later found out, and I think that you have then at that point set him on the path to becoming head of the National Rifle Association. And I want to know if you're going to own up for your terrible responsibility for doing that.
Well, you never know what a simple direction will lead to. Little did I suspect that Charlton would be so turned around by the fact that he was in the most famous homosexual love scene in the history of the movies and never knew it. Where do you go after that but to the NRA?
We tried the back microphone.
I have two questions. One is, there would be a number of people, I think, who would be very glad to be here this evening, except that they're attending a meeting of learning how best to protest the World Trade Organization. And I'm curious to know what advice, if any, you might have for them. My second question is, when in your own life did you experience the greatest personal optimism, and what did that optimism center upon?
Optimism. I'm often accused of pessimism.
Indeed, that's why I'd like to know the converse.
Well, as you suspect, I'm basically an optimist, otherwise I wouldn't be talking to you, would I? Or writing books. We always behave as if what is wrong can be corrected, and it can be, I think. It was Eleanor Roosevelt's line, was it, sooner or later, that if people understood what had gone wrong, that they would act correctly and fix it. And that has always been my sort of political motivation, my motivation for Mexican politics, writing about it. And when the grace entered my soul, I have no idea. I had an exaggerated sense of justice as a child, and I never lost it. I think of the prisons of the United States, and this I feel their pain, unlike Bill, who just feels lots of pain here and there. But I do. The innocent people in prisons, 3 times caught with marijuana, life sentence, privatization of prisons, the biggest growth thing in the country at the moment. This is obscene. And this bothers me every day of my life when I start to think about it, and I start to grind my teeth and write something about it. As for the World Trade Organization, that is, everybody's much exercised here, and I have given it no thought at all. I believe that everybody should be involved in it, and the fact that we don't like the way the Chinese run things, well, Maybe they don't like our prison system. Maybe they don't like the way we do things. I mean, we've committed more crimes against other people since Harry Truman, certainly, than any other country on earth. I think 120 wars, hot, cold, tepid, we've been involved in. We have the Enemy of the Month Club in order to keep the people alarmed. Noriega, Gaddafi. We don't like his eyeliner, so we kill his daughter. Saddam. We're constantly perpetrating acts of violence against other people because we want to tell them what to do. What are we doing in the Balkans? Nobody's ever worked that one out. Part of living part of the time in Italy is I see to what degree the Europeans have come to hate us. And I think we'll be asked to leave NATO within the next year or two. So a wonderful thing for us as well. No, it's a difficult world.
We're ready? Have you crossed paths with Norman Mailer at all? In recent times at all?
Yes, Norman and I acted together, if that is the word, in Don Juan in Hell. And I played the devil, naturally, and Norman played the Commendatore, and Gay Talese played Don Juan, and Susan Sontag played Donna Elena. And we did it as a benefit for the Actors Studio. And it was Norman's idea that they ought to see some real acting. So what better than five writers? Now you're wondering what the writer's role is, playing Don Juan in Hell. And Norman directed it, and we get on pretty well, and generally have. He came to my 70th birthday party, and he proposed a toast. This is all in a documentary I just saw. I'd forgotten it. He proposed a toast saying that our quarrels have been famous but small. That was pretty much it.
I spent a night with him. He was lecturing like you are here about 15 years ago, and I spent a night drinking with him. And I have a favorite question I like to ask. I pointed out to him that Bella Abzug had called Bill Buckley an elitist, and I said, Norman, who would you pick as your favorite elitist? Would you care to make a guess who he picked?
Ronald Reagan?
Well, no, Gloria Steinem picked Ronald Reagan. On that. That's, and then told me 10 years later she didn't remember saying that. But no, Norman picked George Will. No. But
oh, no.
Would you throw out a favorite elitist if I, you know, you, just for fun?
I'm a populist.
Okay.
I like, well, we all like elites if it's an elite of intelligence, yeah. But in our great land, it's always of wealth. And I don't cotton to them very much.
Your dad was said to have been a coach at the University of Oregon. Would that have been, what, early 20s or football coach?
Well, I was 2 years old, so that was 1927.
27, okay.
And we lived in Eugene, but I don't remember any of it.
And one more question. do you know who's the definition of marriage was given by... Was it Oscar Wilde or Oscar Levant, The Conquest of Habit Over Hate? Do you recall if it was one of them? Or?
I don't follow that question.
Definition of marriage, The Conquest of Habit Over Hate. Oscar Levant used to give that one, but I just wondered if it came from...
No, I remember H.L. Mencken said when they commented that despite his many girlfriends, he never got married. And he said, well, it's like asking a man who likes a glass of beer if he wants to go to work in a brewery. He was a sexist.
Mr. Vidal,
yes.
I'm the mother of two small children, and I was wondering if you have any advice for children.
Read. And pay as little attention as possible to what other people think of you. It's much more interesting what you think of them. You can divide up people, you know, but... Defendants, most people are defendants, or prosecutors, there are a few nasty types around. And then there are judges. And I arrived with the whole courtroom, you know, in a black hat for the condemning to death. I came in as a critic, as a judge, and I was always more interested in what I thought of the situation than what the situation might have thought of me. And this gives you a certain degree of independence.
That was Gore Vidal speaking in Portland in 1999. Vidal died in 2012. After his death, the New York Times described Vidal as an Augustan figure who believed himself to be the last of a breed, and he was probably right. Few American writers have been more versatile or gotten more mileage from their talent. You've been listening to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, and the Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. I hope you can join us next time. The Archive Project is a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. We have all our talks online, and you can browse through them at literary-arts.org. Spencer Rimmon produces the Archive Project for Radio. Thanks for joining us.